Our chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you see it coming, no time to beg out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, there'll be no doubt when you see you are. Rest make heaven in the middle of it. Rest make heaven in the middle. We are rest make heaven.
Secret truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. I want to welcome back, boy, we've been with, on our program several times, and we welcome him with open arms, Tony Gosling from Bristol, England. Welcome back, Tony Gosling.
Hi, George. Thanks very much for asking me on again.
Well, I tell you what, a lot is going on, Brexit and this this travel agency and just a lot of plethora of other things, right?
Well, Hunter Biden, too. You know, it's worth saying, I think probably Brexit's a good place to start.
Okay.
And we'll try to get with. I mean, it's really interesting to see what's happened since the new government under Boris Johnson arrived on the scene. Theresa May, let's be absolutely clear here. Theresa May was not even vaguely interested in Brexit. What she was doing was a bit of puppetry, so that she would turn up and give her inane smile and say, yes, we will be leaving on the 29th of March, I promise, blah, blah. And, of course, she never delivered that. But it was far worse than that, George. She's part of a faction in the Conservative Party, a hardcore, around about a quarter or a fifth of the members of Parliament in the Conservative Party who were absolutely committed to staying in the EU. And, you know, she made that clear in the run-up, and that's one of the reasons that she was made a minister and worked her way up to become Home Secretary, which is the Interior Ministry. And that was why, because she, you know, and this is what was going on in the Conservative Party up until then, is almost the only people who got real promotion were the ones who were working with them for the globalists, with them for the Bilderbergs, these kinds of people. And she was one of them. And the two other characters who were the main activists in the Conservative Party for that, one is Oliver Letwin, who's a former employee of N.M. Rothschilds and Sons at the City of London. And the other one is Kenneth Clark, who's the former UK representative on the steering committee of the Bilderberg conferences. So you can see who we're dealing with here. There is a faction in the Tory party, very much like there's a faction in the Labour party, which is not interested in things like public ownership of utilities like water and gas and things like that, which is the traditional Labour heartland. But they're just infiltrators into the party. So both of the main parties have had those people. And those people have been like Tony Blair, John Major in the Conservative Party, Tony Blair in the Labour Party, and Peter Mandelson in the Labour Party. These figures have been the agents of the globalists. One could even argue that they are traitors because they're taking public office in order to dissolve British sovereignty into this new Brussels country. Which is called the EU, which, by the way, of course, now gets its own little speech at the UN General Assembly in New York. Donald Tusk was over there the other day giving his speech as the EU, as if it's a country. So it's no longer really a trade bloc or anything else. It's a country, and it does pretty much whatever Washington tells it, as we've seen with the reaction to the JCPOA, pulling out the JCPOA. So, you know, the globalist project, the United States of Europe, modelled on a kind of United States of America, but even less democratic, with only failed politicians who have been booted out by the voters in power, Brussels. I mean, it really is. It's one step beyond the audacity of a new world order in Washington is the new world order they're trying to put together in Brussels, George.
Exactly.
And, so we've seen a new government come in here, Boris Johnson, and the majority of the Conservative Party, that is to say the membership, absolutely 100% behind Boris. Well, shall we say about 70% behind Boris, because that was the margin he won, the vote, to become Prime Minister amongst the Conservative membership. He's playing a very different game. So, first of all, massive public spending. We had a £14 billion public spending programme as soon as he got in, with the new Chancellor Sajid Javid, who, by the way, is a Bristol boy. Quite proud of him, actually. So £14 billion tap was suddenly switched on. So this is a lot of money coming back into things. You know, if you go around the UK now, they're now hiring police, they're hiring people to work in hospitals, they're hiring people to work in the fire brigades. All these major public services that still operate have had a massive boost of cash. So there's starting to suddenly hire people again. Just on the news here tonight, enormous capital programs going into building extra parts on and maintaining hospitals around Britain. So there's been a big change, which hasn't really been reflected by the mass media at all. And those changes have been brought in by Boris Johnson. Now, I'm not a fan of Boris, but I can recognise that what he's doing is necessary as a sort of gigantic torpedo pointed at Brussels, George. And
really,
what is to say is that actually an individual nation state can look after its people a lot better than Brussels can. And I think this is the example that they're really afraid of in Brussels, is because, of course, the Italian people, the Spanish people, the German people, the French people, the Greek people are all looking at Britain. And once Brexit is over and the British government starts to take control of its own country again, away from these mega gangsters. I'm not saying that all politicians don't have a bit of gangster in them. Of course they do. But the EU really is made up of failed politicians and banksters running the show. And, you know, this is the tax evasion empire that they've got there. And the other thing to say is that Boris did a good speech at the United Nations. I don't know if you saw it, George, or did you see that?
No, I saw part of it, but not all of it, yeah.
It's worth watching. It's for your listeners. It's about 15 minutes long, and he really does lay into the whole takeover of IT, artificial intelligence, all that sort of thing. The stuff Epstein was basically foaming at the mouth about. He loved it, you know. But Boris is saying no, we don't like this. This is creepy. This is weird. And it was a terrific little speech. He wasn't talking about the things we would love to him to talk about, to say, you know, what the hell did the Israelis think they're doing, annexing, you know, the West Bank and the Golan Heights and this sort of thing. We would have loved to hear him say that. And, you know, to talk about Iran as a great country and a democracy that we want to buy oil from. You know, we would have loved to have heard him say, you know, nice things about Russia and China too. But you know, he didn't say those things. But what he is saying is that, you know, we've got to beware of IT, which is, you know, some might say grandstanding, but it was a really good speech and it was well written. And it was by far, I think, the other than Imran Khan, who gave a great, I mean, he's a terrific statesman, the Pakistani prime minister, and a cricketer who spent a lot of time in England. And he's I think, for me, Imran Khan has been the main man there. Very, very sad to see that President Maduro, after all the death threats against him, has not been able to come to New York, George. I mean, that's pretty frightening, isn't it? The Americans are actually abusing their position as the hosts of the United Nations to, you know, make death threats against one of the people from Venezuela who might participate.
Yeah, but look at the state of the economy in Venezuela. It's just a disaster. He hasn't managed his resources well.
And the other thing is the Washington has also taken away the visas for parts of the Russian delegation. Listen, I mean, if the Americans want to play this game, this is not something that most Americans want to see. If the deep state wants to play these games, then what will happen is the UN will move It will move to, you know, have these
to London, Geneva. They move it to London,
you know, or elsewhere, somewhere where there's not these kind of petty point scoring going on. We're saying, oh no, this Russian guy, we're not going to let him come. We're going to stop his visa. You know, this
well,
is
you're
silly.
Right
this
about that.
Stuff.
If you have a UN and you're the host, you've got to allow all the nation's leaders there to come there. That's
you've got
just,
to allow
yeah.
your worst enemy, and then you've got to yeah. actually give them the red carpet treatment. It might actually, you might not like it. You might have to stomach it for a week, but then you know you can get back to hating them again. But you do have to be a good host. And
yeah, that's right. Yeah, you can do that for a while.
Been fascinating also to see, George, what's been happening with the actual Brexit deadline, which is coming up on Halloween. Well, I call it the banksters rising from the dead on Halloween, because I think that's what we may see. I mean, there's been this thing called the Benn Act in Parliament here and the Supreme Court judgment. Fascinating, the Supreme Court, Lady Hale, with the gigantic diamond in studded spider on her. Did you see that?
No, I didn't.
Okay, this is the Supreme Court Chief Justice Lady Hale giving her judgment, saying that Boris Johnson broke the law when
suspension overruled that.
So Parliament's come back, but then you know Boris has actually done a fantastic job, I think, in a way, because Parliament's come back and all they're doing is the same old screaming and shouting and petty nonsense, and most of the people in the country are thinking, well, actually, do we really want Parliament back? It doesn't really seem to be saying anything useful. They're not doing anything useful. They're just coming out with the same old rubbish. And so, you know, this is really what they've done, I think, by getting the Supreme Court to do what they wanted, because, of course, that is a new kind of an institution. They've been invading. It's a very political decision by the Supreme Court. They shouldn't be getting themselves involved in politics, and none of the senior justices in the country or judges or solicitors would say that the courts should be doing that. Of course they shouldn't, taking sides in an enormous political debate like that. But anyhow, they're scoring points. We've seen Laura Koonsberg, the political editor at the BBC, just basically spending tonight's evening news running through various things over the last two or three weeks that Boris Johnson is supposed to have done wrong. This is news. They're just recycling smears, and this is what's passing for news now, I'm afraid, on the BBC. I would imagine, you know, post-Brexit things might change, but anyway, the point really is, as we're coming closer and closer to the big day in October, Boris has made it quite clear. He says he's going to abide by the law, which is telling him that he's got to have an extension to the Brexit deal. This is this new law that Parliament has passed. But we are going to leave on the 31st. And I think that's quite almost definitely now. I mean, a lot of people might disagree with me, and there may be other shenanigans happening in the meantime. But if Boris stays in there as Prime Minister up until the 31st of October, another month, it's almost certain he's going to leave. And the only way that the opposition can really get him out is to have a general election, which they would almost certainly lose. The polls today, George, let me just tell you, over this weekend in the Express, are saying 35% want Corbyn in number 10, and 48%, which is more than, what is that? That's about 13% higher, want Boris in number 10, and they want no deal. So Corbyn, if he does go for a general election, he's going to lose. And so that's why he hasn't gone for a general election. So I think we'll be leaving, George. I really do, because all of the puff about, oh, it's terrible, this no deal is going to be a disaster, it may be true. It may be a total disaster, because the international financial system will throw everything at Britain. They will be shorting the pound. They'll be trying to collapse the British economy. There'll be a economic warfare being waged full scale from Brussels and from the basically, well, not just from Brussels, from the Bilderberg elite that have done their best to build this European appalling European project, which is totally undemocratic. So that, I think, it's my prediction is we will leave, and that there will be some sort of economic tsunami will come across the channel and hit, maybe even wash right up the Thames like a great tidal wave.
Boy, Tony, you're describing things good. You ought to write some novels or something.
This is. I mean, the thing is, what is going on, George, is you'll find most of the news nowadays, I don't know about over there, but certainly over here, it's scripted. It's been scripted. It's been written. This is the way things are supposed to happen. Many of the politicians, when they're giving their speeches, they're just simply looking at a piece of paper that someone else has written for them below the lectern. They're not able to really speak from the heart. And, you know, that's what I think is, for me, is one of the big tests of, in journalism and politics, is if people are able to just speak from the heart without just reading a script. I don't want politicians reading a script. I just don't like to see it. But so that's my prediction, and that's what Boris has said he'd do. So we're kind of stuck, even though he's in a minority government, he has the country behind him. So Parliament is basically, it's been sidelined. You've got the government and the people on one page, and you've got the courts, the judiciary, and Parliament on the other page, and they are all representing this globalist elite oligarchy. And looking over at the US, I can see a similar sort of smear campaign going on against Trump, as we've seen that, you know, we had the Stormy Daniels business, we had the Russiagate, and now we've got the latest one is Bidengate, which is Nelson Biden, is that his name?
Joe Biden and Hunter Biden.
Hunter Biden, I keep calling him Nelson, I don't know why.
Hunter Biden is
his son. Bit of a bad boy. He's obviously thinks he's like a kind of hood of some kind that goes around the world sort of bullying people. And in Ukraine, he's been doing that. And he bullied the prosecutor to not prosecute the big gas company. He was a natural gas company he was working for in Ukraine.
Joe intimidated them with withdrawing a $1 billion aid to Ukraine. And what he did was on a panel discussion at the Council on Foreign Relations and bragged about it on a panel discussion. He sort of indicted himself, Joe Biden did.
Members of the Council on Foreign Relations may as well be members of the Illuminati as far as
exactly,
I'm concerned.
Exactly, that's the deal. You're right on top of that.
They are basically on another page to the rest of the world. They've got their own little plan they want to try and take over. They want a coup against us. The CFR, like the Royal Institute for International Affairs in London, is really just an attempt to parasite on the democratic institutions and duplicate them and to try and take them over. It's a kind of parallel structure, like the ivy running up a tree. You know, that's what these organizations are, the CFR, very much. And so that's quite clear that there is nothing in this Trump transcript that is in any way, incriminating. And what he's doing is he's basically saying, look, just tip me the wink about what happened with the Biden guy. You know, this is not a problem. And that I don't think this impeachment's going anywhere. And like the previous impeachments, George, but also, you know, you mentioned at the beginning, the collapse of the British travel firm.
Yes, uh-huh. What happened there on that?
This travel firm in the world, and it was organising package tours in the 1800s. I mean, it's just an amazing little firm, but it's been completely sabotaged. And it's fascinating to see how these things work. The company that tried to organise the rescue deal is really well worth looking at. You know, use your favourite search engine, not necessarily Google, and look them up. And they're called CQS Management.
Okay.
And they're a major Tory party donor. And this guy, he was organising the so-called rescue deal for Thomas Cook, okay? And he was working with Lloyds Bank, with RBS, and as a hedge fund, he was the guy who was kind of getting all these so-called deals together, ready to save the firm. Because it's actually, you know, it's making profit, but it's got a lot of debt. So, you know, it's just basically a debt restructuring. Anyway, it turns out the Financial Times revealed he's also got $250 million of credit default swaps on Thomas Cook failing.
Oh, my gosh. My gosh.
So how about that? The guy that's organizing the financial rescue deal has quietly behind his back been betting on the company collapsing.
Oh, I tell you, isn't that something?
Crazy. Man. We've got to do something about these derivatives, these credit default swaps, because what it does is it gives people, a pickup truck full of gold bars for destroying a company. Now, Naomi Klein is quite right with her book about disaster capitalism. This is a massive profit-making exercise, collapsing these companies. What I'm so disgusted with, though, is the complete and utter failure of the British press to really expose this. It's only the FT that is even mentioned that he had these $250 million worth of credit default swaps. And that is pretty much, you know, what it would have taken to ensure the company survived. And, you know, what you've got is you've got 6,000-7,000 people thrown on the dole, you know, so they haven't got their jobs anymore. There's tens of thousands of holidaymakers that had to be rescued by the British government. And, you know, basically this is because nowadays it's quite easy to do this stuff. You know, all you do is bet on a company going down flatly. And then you say, oh, we're going to do the rescue deal. And you have no intention whatsoever of actually rescuing the firm. Your intention while you're sitting down with the staff is to destroy it. And it's interesting that the guy who was the chief executive for the last 4 or 5 years, he's actually not even British. He's Swiss-German. So there is no loyalty to the British economy for somebody from Switzerland. He's just happens to be, you know, so-called good. And what happens, of course, George, with a lot of these deals, people need to be aware how this works, is the banks will say, well, we will refinance your company, but only if you have this and this and this X, Y, and Z chief executive, financial officer, blah, blah. Yeah, so the banks are in a position, and have been over the last 15 years or so, and Thomas Cook has been in trouble, to say, well, you will only survive to live another day if you have the executives in place on your firm's board that we choose. So, but once they've got their people in place, it's a very simple exercise for someone to come along then and say, right, you know, Mr. X, you know, we know you, you're a good pal of mine, let's just do a £250 million bet that your company's going to collapse. And I'll, you know, give you some of the cash. So this really is international gangsterism, and the shocking thing is that the press hardly picks up on it, George.
Oh, man. That's something else, boy. It's good that y'all found that out. What's going to happen now? Will there be charges against him or some kind of charges?
Nothing, because the criminal elite's center for criminal financial activity is the City of London. I mean, it's not the first time. The City of London has been involved all the way down the line, George, in history's crimes. I mean, the first most awful crime, really, was the crimes against King Charles I in the English Civil War.
Yeah.
People don't realise this. The City of London had gangs of armed thugs, very much like Hitler's SA, you know, the brown shirts, okay, in the 1930s. And they were running around in the English Civil War, just making sure that anybody that was pro-Charles I and against Cromwell was beaten up. So they didn't always kill them, but they would beat them up. So basically gangs of thugs, all organized from the City of London. And when Charles I arrived in Parliament in 1642 to arrest they're called the five members who were agitating against him, and he said he was going to get these five MPs arrested who had been organizing these sorts of criminal activities and involved with these thugs. What happened is they were, and that's the famous phrase, the birds have flown. And that was those five MPs who had been whisked away and were being hidden by the City of London. And that was the point at the beginning of the English Civil War. That really was the event that marked the beginning of it. And it went on and on. And it was really a battle between the City of London, who wanted to the power to create the currency of the nation and wanted to wrest it away from the king. And, of course, once the Civil War was over and done with, by the time we get to the 1690s, that's when the Bank of England was created, controlled and owned by the city. And that was really what the English Civil War was all about. It was, you know, about the control of money, just as you had your Jekyll Island debacle at the beginning of the 1900s over in the United States, George, a wrestle between who is going to control the money. Is it private merchant interests, as it was in the City of London, or is it going to be the president in the US, or is it going to be the king in England? You know, so that's really what this is all about, these private interests wanting to control the issuance of money. And, of course, that's the lifeblood of the nation. And if you can control that, then you can hold the entire nation to ransom. And that's why we've got basically a gangster system now in the West, and particularly in Britain and America.
Yeah, you know what's funny is that some of the people that are real close to the Federal Reserve here have been calling Trump a godfather. Can you believe that?
They do. They've called the other side what they are. Seeing this in the Brexit debacle here with Parliament calling Boris Johnson anti-democratic.
Yeah,
and it's just
like,
because it's Parliament that is trying to overturn the decision of the people. And the thing is that they keep coming out with these very, very thin, empty excuses, Parliament do. They say, maybe we'll have another referendum. Well, okay, so is there any guarantee that you're going to do what you're instructed by that referendum? Oh, well, maybe we'll have a referendum between a deal and remain. Ah, right. Well, that's not really a referendum, is it? And that's not what we asked in the first place. And so who is being anti-democratic here? Who is not reflecting the views of the people? Well, by all means, have another referendum, but we've got to leave the European Union first. You know, that's what the people have instructed. So Jacob Rees-Mogg was quite right when he talked about the Illuminati in the British Parliament, which I was very surprised to hear him doing a few weeks ago. And he said that it was a bunch of Illuminati that were behind the anti-Brexit activities. Amazing to hear him say that. But his main point wasn't that. His main point was that the sovereignty that Parliament has comes from the people. And if they start to forget that they're servants of the people and start to see themselves as masters over the people, then either an election will remove them or there could be a serious political crisis, even civil war. So this is where the agents of chaos in Parliament have been moving us towards actual civil unrest. So I don't think we're going to see that. I think we're going to see the establishment, parts of it anyway, because this is a war between different factions in the establishment in Britain. And I think we'll see Brexit happen. And what's the biggest thing which I've seen as a change is under Theresa May, every move that Theresa May made was exposed to public view. Every tactic that she wanted to use against the European Union in negotiating, which didn't amount to much, was in the news. It was released to the public. Whatever it is that Boris Johnson and the present government intend to do, they are not talking about it, George. They're not saying anything about it. They're saying, oh, we're going to leave legally on the 31st of October. Do or die. That was the expression used by Boris Johnson. So it's interesting to see, you know, that there seems to be a little bit of spirit still left in parts of the British establishment, George.
Yeah, that is interesting, Tony. That's very interesting.
So important, because all the other nations in Europe are watching. Every other nation.
Oh, well, this one really point I wanted to make was the British trade
of the EU. That's what it's all about. And if Brexit happens, and almost whatever the consequences are after that, the European Union is dead duck.
I think the trade favors the European Union. I think UK actually buys more from the EU than the EU buys from England. So I think they're not going to want to give that business up on trade.
Well, they don't care about money, George. I'm afraid that money is just a tool for political power. If they if they're going to lose a bit of money by keeping Britain in the EU, they'll lose the money. They're not really that interested. What they really want is money as a vehicle, as a tool to power. These people are power hungry. They're power crazy. Yeah. They like coups. Anything to do with taking more power. You know, pulling a fast one over the people. That's why they buy up political parties. You know, that's why that we got people like Tony Blair. That's why they buy up media institutions. They buy up mass media. You know, they infiltrate organisations like I work for, which is the public broadcaster in Britain, the BBC. But, you know, this is what their object is. It's a multifaceted approach. Money and ownership is just one aspect that they want to use. And of course, you go back to look at the banks and the Second World War. We had a system that the Nazis used, and probably the British Empire were using it too, where you buy up shares in national banks around the world, and by doing so, you're then buying up their industries. And so you can pretty much get the control of two-thirds of a country's industry just through buying up their banks and getting shares in those banks. And you can then start nominating your own people to be on the boards of those companies. And you don't need to invade a country with tanks, with aircraft, with bombs and guns and soldiers if you can just buy the whole lot up. And that's the way Europe has operated. You know, British industry, the whole of the infrastructure of Britain pretty much has now been bought up by foreign businesses, by foreign companies. And that was all started through the beginnings of the common market and the relaxation of exchange controls that Margaret Thatcher did. And we've just had some expose in the Daily Telegraph, which is a new book by Charles Moore, who was the editor of the Daily Telegraph. The editor of the Spectator magazine. And Charles has exposed John Major's role in getting rid of Thatcher. Now, he's, of course, someone who was a very one-dimensional, I wouldn't even say two-dimensional. He couldn't hardly string two words together as a personality to be prime minister. Everyone was very, very disappointed in having him as a representative of the country. However much we dislike Margaret Thatcher, at least she had something to her. She was a two- or three-dimensional person. But his role was very important. The Maastricht Treaty in 1993, once Thatcher had been booted out by Heseltine and the other globalists, that was setting us on the road to the European Union, and John Major made sure we signed up to that. But that, of course, was another act of treachery, much like Ted Heath in the 1970s, in 1972, signing Britain into the European Union. Without even so much as a referendum, actually, at the time. It was a common market, but, you know, that was the beginning of the process. There was no referendum given to the people at all. And, of course, Heath, for anyone that pays attention, people will know, was a child abuser. He had a very great appetite for young men, and he tried to keep it secret, and now, of course, much of that has all come out. Even through Mike Veal, who was the chief constable of Wiltshire, where Ted Heath lived, he said he was 120% certain, this is the chief constable, that Ted Heath was a paedophile. Now, I don't agree with him. I don't think he was a paedophile. No. I think he was a child abuser. He abused young men and older boys. But, you know, there is a subtle difference there. But that's not the point. The point is that this was the guy that signed us into this project in the first place. And I would suggest it's pretty obvious why. Because he was a child abuser, he was a very easy man to blackmail, George. And that's
exactly
one of the reasons.
That's what happens, doesn't it?
We've had this scandal running on and on and on is because blackmail is the greatest way to blackmail people is that they're paedophiles. It's no good anymore just to say, oh, such and such has had an affair, he's cheated on his wife. That's not good enough to blackmail someone with. But it certainly is. Child abuse is one of the most horrific and horrendous crimes, and that's why I think we've seen the intelligence agencies, particularly Epstein and the Mossad, using this tactic in order to blackmail people. It's a basic mafia tactic. And, you know, the Israeli mafia, the Zionist mafia, just as much likely to use it as the Italian mafia or any other mafia, George.
Right. Steve Pachenik says that the Mossad was involved with Jeffrey Epstein. That's what he says. He made that statement on one of his broadcasts.
Maxwell, this is the question here, is we've had all these other questions, but what's happened to Ghislaine Maxwell? She's a criminal. I don't care who she's working for. Someone has got to feel her collar, please. Any police officers out there, spot her in the street. Why don't you put out a warrant for her arrest? She's quite obviously a sex trafficker. She should go to court. And if she wants, she can turn Queen's evidence, or whatever you call it in the States.
Right.
She can say, well,
state's evidence. Here, yeah.
Organization. Right. And she can help the police to net the real big fish. But I'm afraid most of our senior cops are lily-livered, George. They're not prepared to go for the real big criminals. And as we heard with the Epstein case, apparently he's hands-off. Well, that's not good enough. There's no one on this face of this planet that's hands-off when it comes to sexually abusing children.
Right, exactly. But what they did with him, they got rid of him, see, because he knew too much. So, you know.
Ghislaine knows it all as well. Let's get hold of her and give her a nice, polite police interrogation and also give her some protection so that no one's going to kill her. And then we might actually get somewhere with this. But the idea that the press can just turn the other way and let Ghislaine carry on is beyond a joke. It really is. I mean, everybody knows that she's the one that needs to now be in the dock. And even if she's not in the dock, she needs to be talking to the police and telling them everything. And it doesn't seem as if there's anyone wants to touch her because she's part of the mafia. And the mafia is, you know, the police are just not prepared to take them on, it seems.
Yeah, Jeffrey Epstein's shenanigans and his connections reach to the top of the power structure here and in Europe. So that's why it doesn't go anywhere.
I mean, we've had some distractions though from that, which is like this massive attack on the Saudi oil plants, which is actually, I think, timed to coincide with the UN General Assembly. I don't know what your thoughts are, George, but that seems perfect timing just for everyone. This gives the Saudis something to think about. I don't know if you heard this morning that Mohammed bin Salman, or I think is it maybe his father's top security guard, has been shot dead over in Saudi Arabia.
Oh, really?
In a house. Yeah, I mean, you know, this is the so-called main ruler, although MBS is doing most of the running of the country in Saudi Arabia. There's some sort of row broke out in their palatial home.
Really?
And so the main security guard was just shot dead. So quite whether, you know, he's trying to defend the king. I mean, this is implied that the attacks on these oil installations had help from within Saudi Arabia, because the Saudis are the Yemenis. Yemenis are the Saudis. They're really the artificial division was put there by the British between Yemen.
They were, weren't they?
Saudi Arabia. So there is a quite a strong faction within Saudi Arabia that is sympathetic with the Yemenis and doesn't like to see the mass bombing of children, women, and the destruction of UNESCO sites. I mean, they're in a situation now where there's virtually no military targets left in Yemen. Everything has been smashed to pieces by the British bombs, the British planes, the American planes, and in this proxy war. So Saudi Arabia is looking extremely fragile, which is why it doesn't surprise me that the king's main security guard's been shot dead today, George.
Boy, that's something to think about right there. So there could be real problems with... You remember when Salman went out and arrested all those princes and everything? He created a storm within the upper level of Saudi.
The thing is, I don't think there's a lot of confidence in the leadership. And the reason is because that leadership is a puppet of the West. They have been really ever since the, you know, 1945 February, Bitter Lake, the negotiations between King Abdulaziz of Saudi Arabia and President Roosevelt over the future relationship between Saudi Arabia and the US after the war. I mean, that really started this, you know, the oil pumping, and the relationship between the US and Saudi Arabia was going to be, you know, very, very close ever since then. And and the Brits, of course. Although the Brits were sort of moved out, the empire was moved out, the Brits have still been involved. And Saudi Aramco is a very, very big, powerful industry. And, you know, even if these oil fields are destroyed, George, I think what we might see is we might see the West having to suck it up and start buying oil from Venezuela and buying oil from Iran too. And just, you know, if they're really stupid, they won't. You know, but actually, at the end of the day, the people who will really benefit from any kind of war that happens down there, although, you know, they're desperate to get a war going with Iran, it seems. You know, everything is blamed on Iran, although I don't think they were even involved in this. It looks to me as if the Houthis have been buying bits and pieces of drones and stuff from Iran, and they may be acting possibly from Iraq to bomb Saudi Arabia, but, you know, it's the Iranians doing this. He may be helping and may be advising, possibly.
Well, and now we have what we call a national. We have what we call a National Geospatial Intelligence Agency. It is the largest agency in this country now, and it has satellites all over the world. You know, and it can drill down and find out and tell us, but it has not presented us the direct evidence yet. See what I mean? That the Iranians did it.
It didn't warn the Saudis that the drones were coming, did it?
No. So it's questionable how culpable the Iranians are on this. I don't know.
George, these attacks may have been allowed to happen deliberately because the Israelis want to inflame tensions down there, you know, and to try and get this war going with Iran.
The Israelis want us to attack Iran, and this is not. One thing about Trump is he's hesitant about doing that. You remember the gas attacks in Syria by the White Helmets?
That's why we've seen another attempt to impeach him, is he won't start a war with Iran. You know, the last time.
That's it.
You know,
they want him to attack Iran and won't do it.
The only reason that they dropped the charges against against Trump, you know, that dropped the Mueller case against for impeachment, over Russiagate, was because Trump recognized the Golan Heights. And, you know, if you're looking at the geopolitics of this, you stand back from it, maybe standing on the moon watching this, George, or whatever, you'll see these things happening at the same time. So Trump recognizes the Golan Heights. The next day, Mueller drops the impeachment case. So then Trump is, there's pressure put on Trump to help begin this attack on war on Iran, blaming Iran for everything and then actually acting against Iran. And then what happens? Oh, we're going to impeach you again for this. And actually they're running out of real reasons. And I think he's absolutely right to talk about the fake news, George, because that's the only sort of thing that we seem to be seeing now.
There is one aspect to this.
Here we're seeing just incriminations and smears on the news. There's nothing really left there anymore.
There is one thing about this impeachment. It's a dangerous situation for Trump because the senators that need to vote for conviction, they may get the vote to convict him on an impeachment charge because the New World Order is against him. See what I mean?
It doesn't mean a damn thing. Yeah, you know, it really doesn't.
I know, but what I'm saying is the votes may be there, even though it's not a legitimate charge, and he might be gone by end of this year.
Well, that's possible, but I don't honestly think, unless they, you know, really totally fix the courts, it does seem as if we may be looking at here is a real attempt to destabilize. I mean, we've seen a massive attempt to destabilize politics in Britain by having this parliament that's
exactly, you know,
trying to commit suicide, national suicide. And maybe the same sort of thing going on in the United States. So this all points to me towards destabilization of politics on both sides of the Atlantic by who? By the pro-Israel-Iran war faction. This is the Bilderberg faction, the Bankster faction that just want to kick this war off come what may. And it might be simply that the impeachment and other attempts to destabilize U.S. politics are just a symptom of that, George.
Yeah, that's a good point. We had the Gladio in Europe. Well, I have a site up called AmericanGladio.com. And some of these mass shootings over here are operations, I'm afraid. See what I mean? So we've got that to contend with, in addition to the attacks on Trump and everything else.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, I've been doing a bit more work for you. You know, there's a lot of people get on to me from, well, not a lot of people, but people from time to time get on to me to say, we want to hear more about Martin Bormann, Tony.
Right.
Because I've been, you know, one of the researchers around the world that's really looked into this guy. I mean, he was Hitler's secretary. He was also the treasurer for the Nazi Party's bank accounts.
Right.
He had the keys to roughly $1 billion worth of wealth at the end of World War II. And if you buy a book called OpJB, Operation James Bond is short for OpJB by Christopher Crichton, what you'll see is that Bormann was brought out of Berlin right at the end of the war under the noses of the Russians by British commandos who were trained down at Hailing Island, the summit called HMS Northney. And those commandos led by the author of the book, Christopher Crichton, or John Ainsworth Davis, Christopher Crichton's his pen name, and the famous Ian Fleming of James Bond fame. That operation was really interesting because, of course, he was the only person that anyone was really interested in at the end of the war because he had all the money looted from the whole of Europe. Over 6 years of World War II. And so they were very interested in him and they were prepared to give him a new identity and everything if they could get their hands on some of that loot. There's two books. That was that one I mentioned, OpJB by Christopher Crichton, which talks about getting Bormann out of Nazi Germany at the end of April, it was May the 1st to the 11th, the operation, because they had to get him through the Russian sector on the rivers and the canals to the Allied sector, which wasn't an easy job. So it was about something like 6 or 7 days of canoeing with Bormann. But they had a Russian speaking officer with them, and she would stand up. If the Russians challenged, she'd shout at them in Russian.
Oh, man.
And that they were looking for Nazi war criminals and that they'd be reported to Zhukov if they so much as delayed them. And obviously they were not, you know, the Russian soldiers were not prepared to sort of challenge somebody who said they were a Russian general. So that's how they got through the Russian lines. And they got all the way to, so Bormann comes to London, and then your very own Paul Manning, who's probably one of the greatest American journalists of all time.
He's a great guy, yeah.
He was a CBS correspondent in World War II reporting for the US public on the war in Europe. And he wrote Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, all about Bormann's activities in South America. And this was creating 750 corporations in order to basically launder the Nazi loot through Sullivan and Cromwell, the Dulles Brothers law firm in New York, into these businesses. And then on the boards of those businesses, there were loads of ex-Nazis, or ex-SS people, plus loads of collaborators, people that helped the Nazis in occupied Europe, and of course, in the United States, part of the America First network that tried to keep America out of World War II. A lot of those were very friendly with the Nazis. They gave them jobs, and to cap it all, they put Jewish people, Zionists, usually Zionists, on the boards of these companies. The idea being that no one could imagine that Nazi money had been given to a Jew on the board, you know. So if they've got quite a good presence of Jews on the board of a company, no one will ever suspect that this is laundered Nazi money behind the business. So that was a really devious act that they did. But the big gap, George, has been where was Bormann in between times? So he went to South America around about 1956. But he was in Berlin up until 1945. Where was he in between? And my investigations here in Britain have point towards a little town called Reigate on the North Downs in Surrey, which is just south of London. And there was a bunker there under the hills, which was going to be used for the defense of London in case of a Nazi invasion. And that bunker also had little tunnels going to some of the nice suburban houses. This place was never bombed in the war, so it was completely invulnerable. And it was a perfect place to hide somebody like Bormann. And that actually seems to be what happened there, because he could sort of walk into one house, disappear down the tunnel, pop up in another house, and he was in one of the most secure bunker complexes in the whole of Britain, which would have been used to defend the country, Southeastern Command for the British Army, if we were invaded. So this seems to me to be the place. And the thing that's a real clincher is that there was a guy in Reigate who was a Bormann double, and called Broderick Hartley. Now, no one's really quite sure whether he was Bormann, or in fact, it looks as if that this was a new identity they gave him, but they had a double as well. So this was investigated by the News of the World and the Mail on Sunday in 1995, because the Bormann's son, apparently, came to the journalist and said, well, look, I'm Martin Bormann's son, and I'm living in Reigate, and here's all the evidence. And he showed this to the journalists, and they were gobsmacked. Gosh, this guy really is Martin Bormann's son. What's he doing here? At which point, this kid was, well, he wasn't a kid by that time, but he was arrested by the police on drugs charges. And guess what, George? He apparently hanged himself in jail whilst he was on remand before he went to court.
I think
that's where the trail leads to, and it'd be interesting to see where this story goes in the future. That you know, all this nonsense talked about Hitler surviving. No. It was Martin Bormann that survived, and Bormann was, I think, working with the Brits. So that's the secretary of Winston Churchill, Desmond Morton, working very closely with the secretary of Hitler, Martin Bormann, really for the last 6 months of the war, doing all sorts of deals, knowing that they were going to lose the war, but making sure that they had safe passage after the war. And so I'm trying to put together the sort of pieces of this, and it's all pointing towards the innocent and beautiful, actually has to be said, town of Reigate. And I got a bit of help from the deputy head of the local junior school in Reigate, Grace Philby. She's written stuff on this, and she's done a whole super presentation called Churchill's Secret Reigate, which looks at this aspect of the story. But funnily enough, the presentation that she gave before she died, George, you won't believe this, the bit about the Bormann double and where Martin Bormann was in Reigate, right. Unfortunately, it was missing from the final tape of the talks that she gave.
Oh, my God.
She was a Churchill fellow, you know?
Yeah.
So she was to the establishment, and she was actually introduced by one of the Balfours at her talk. So, you know, all roads lead to Reigate, I'm afraid, from Berlin to Reigate and then to Buenos Aires. I think that's where the commander of the Nazi loot went. And yeah, this is, of course, guessing. Fleming would have known about this. Why he couldn't actually write a factual account of it. But he did try and give us as many clues as possible in his James Bond books. And the person who really has to be patted on the back probably more than anyone else is the guy that wrote the factual account. That is John Ainsworth Davis, and his pen name, Christopher Crichton. He had to use a pen name, George, because he was afraid still that he would be arrested under the Official Secrets Act for writing that book.
But yeah, he was revealing a bunch of things about British intelligence. That's true. Yes. I did some research on...
A lot of people that knew stuff about what was going on in the war, like Dennis Wheatley, and Ian Fleming, Neville Shute as well as another one. These people, Len Dayton too. These writers put a lot of clues in their books about what really happened, but the only person I know that's really written this factual account, that's been brave enough to write it as a factual account, was John Ainsworth Davis, the Christopher Crichton, the pen name in this book, OpJB, which is an absolutely riveting read. If any of your listeners want to get hold of the book, I thoroughly guarantee that they will enjoy it.
Okay, I came up with, you know, this Burisma company out of the Ukraine. It comes under the Burisma Holdings or Burisma Group.
Got them.
And here's what I found. I found that the existing chairman of the board of Burisma Group was formerly with Sullivan Cromwell. His name was Alan Apter.
Under them still.
They're all connected, see?
There's only a handful of these people, aren't there? Amazing, they can blight the world in this manner. I mean,
here's an important thing, too, Tony, is Kofor Black. He formerly ran the Black operation for the CIA, and he's a director of that company today.
Okay. So the CIA. He was the first CIA director.
Yeah. So, you know, the they're saying that the owner, the dominant owner of this Burisma, was doing money laundering, and they froze some monies of one of the principals over there in London and released it recently, $23 million. But to dress up the company, he brought these people in. See what I mean?
The CIA first director was who?
The what now?
Who was the first director of the CIA? William Donovan.
He was OSS. He became the first director.
CIA director. And, it may be, some sort of other director general.
But Alan Dulles was right there at the beginning of the OSS because he was in Switzerland.
But Donovan was the American liaison for Operation James Bond, for this Op JB, for bringing Borman. So that's another connection to this really important little mission with these, crazy canoes in their commando boats, many of whom actually got killed on the way. But Borman was brought out safely to the Allied sector. And it's interesting, I think, that Donovan was, as the liaison officer, was chosen after the war by the Dulles brothers to be the first CIA boss,
Well, both the Dulles brothers were connected to Sullivan Cromwell. So it would have been that law firm. Both of them were connected. Yeah.
I mean, we're talking 0.0000001%. If our law enforcement people cannot get their hands and feel the collars of these guys and stick them behind bars, then I'm afraid we're going to go to hell in a handbasket, George.
Well, it's a money power that controls the whole system. So, London, New York, Frankfurt,
power.
Yeah. Now the Chinese are involved with the big money, so they're a big factor now.
I've got no faith in, I'm afraid, in the Chinese. It's very interesting what's going on in Hong Kong, of course. We haven't really mentioned that, but, they're being egged on by MI6, no doubt about it, and the CIA. But there is a genuine, genuine fear in Hong Kong by almost every single person I met, and I was there, about China. And China is going to have to compromise with Hong Kong because they cannot force millions of people to just adopt a totalitarian brainwashed mind. It's not going to happen. So, the Chinese are just not going to be able to control Hong Kong. And if they do try to control it, then they might find that the whole of China blowing up behind them as they're facing Hong Kong.
I think they have 28 years left on this 50-year agreement, I think. Okay? I think there are 28 years left. There was a 50-year agreement they made for both Macau and Hong Kong.
It's supposed to be part of China, ruled by Beijing. I don't think that's ever going to happen, George. I just can't see it now.
Well, the main thing that's happened in Hong Kong is that in 10, 15 years ago, they were handling most of the trade through that harbors and stuff, and now they're down to maybe just a few percent of the total trade in and out of China, so that's hurt them a lot.
And obviously Beijing too.
Yeah.
But I would suggest, it's one of those countries, Hong Kong, go and see it while you can. Visit the place quick.
Need to go. I'm excited now. I need to go. Well, look, I certainly appreciate you coming on late notice here, Tony, and you really have expressed some very good things on the air.
I just hope that the Brexit business isn't too painful. We've seen so many scare stories, I think it might be. Yeah. Also, I just want to see basic, decent journalism again. And I think, this is one of the things that the Brussels institutions have done to this country is that they have tried to control and denude our journalism. In fact, they've been extremely good at it so that it's become just nonsense. People don't want to watch the TV. They think it's rubbish. There's nowhere near enough satire, which would be, it's very easy. People are throwing things at their TV, laughing at the TV.
Oh, really?
That's what people do over here. And so I think Brexit could be a great catharsis. I just hope that they've made some pretty damn good preparations for...
It's not going to affect y'all's trade that much. It's going to continue on. It's not going to be the big disruptor that people think it's going to be. I don't think it's going to disrupt.
It'll be like Y2K, But then, of course,
exactly. They'll
try and make an example of us, George, but let's hope that the, gangsters in the City of London are not all Brussels gangsters, and the one or two of them will be gangstering for us, George, eh?
Right. Anyway, I appreciate it. Anyway, thank you a lot. Okay, Tony. Thank you so much.
All the best.
Yeah.
Bye.
Bye-bye.